Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. West Virginia lawmakers are looking into ways to prevent another chemical spill.
Require that these facilities be registered and regularly inspected.
Some Pennsylvania residents face paying a rain tax.
And in fact, we try not to call it a tax increase because it is really a user fee.
A telescope in danger of closing is still making far-out discoveries.
Could this discovery have been made without the GBT? Possibly.
A West Virginia community is fixing its own water problems.
My kids grew up, the water was orange, and they didn't know it wasn't supposed to be.
These stories and more coming up this week on a wet episode of Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly, in for Cecilia Mason. West Virginia lawmakers are responding to the chemical spill that contaminated water for more than 300,000 West Virginia American Water customers. State Senate Majority Leader John Unger introduced a bill Thursday that would require all above-ground storage facilities for liquids be registered and inspected. West Virginia Public Radio's Cecilia Mason talked with Unger about why the legislation is needed and what it would do.
Several years ago, we worked on the legislation, and I introduced a bill called the West Virginia Water Resource Protection and Management Act that did three things at that time. One is to claim the water as the property of the people of West Virginia. The second is we had an inventory, so we know what resources we have. And the third thing we've done is create a management plan in order to better manage that resource to ensure availability to anyone, any resident or business or a farmer in West Virginia. So what this will do is this will add the protection component to it that has been demonstrated with this situation that we've learned from, and we're going to put provisions in place so that we can better protect and manage that resource so people have confidence in their drinking water. Below ground tanks are permitted and inspected, and even the tankers that travel our roadways, particularly our interstate highways, they're also registered and inspected. But for some reason, and I didn't realize this until this situation, our above ground holding facilities, liquid holding facilities, are not inspected. Petroleum tanks may have limited inspection, but other types of chemicals or other types of liquids are not. And so what this legislation would do is actually require that these facilities be registered and regularly inspected by the Department of Environmental Protection. Also, it could be looked at siting of these facilities. So chemicals such as what we have here that came into the Elk River that created this crisis, you know, something like that may not be permitted to locate so close to a waterway that maybe it's further inland, so that if there is an incident, it could be quickly mitigated before it ever got into a water stream of some sort that would affect anybody. And so these are the types of things that we need to have information on so we can have these discussions with the corporations. In no way do we want to inhibit what processes are going on and the economic development that's happening with that industry. What we're asking is that they register and allow for inspections on a regular basis to ensure that the standards are there and that this type of incident won't happen again. And I think that's a small thing to ask of these corporations that are here in order to ensure the safety of the residents in the surrounding area and even further down, as we are learning that this chemical is flowing down to Huntington that affects other communities. And so I just think this is something that we can do and we can do quickly. I've asked that General Hoyer look at doing risk assessments now as we're trying to get this legislation through and putting it in place to look at what's out there, the map, what type of facilities are there, and to come up with some idea of what we're talking about in regards to the types of chemicals that are up and down this valley and throughout the state. in order to at least have that information. And then once the legislation is passed, then we will have a process in which these corporations, these companies, can register their facilities and what type of liquid that they're holding in those holding facilities above ground.
And would it also make them have meet certain standards in order to have the facility? Like, for instance, if you have a landfill, it has to be lined. I mean, will there be standards?
Sure. Yeah, there are standards in which these, depending on the liquid or the chemical, there are certain standards that are in place already out there, but it's just not being enforced in the sense there's no mechanism of enforcement because there's no mechanism of inspection. And so, yes, we would hold these companies or individuals that have these holding facilities as, to meet the standards that are required in order to properly properly hold the liquid that they're using.
So the law would also tell them they not only have to register, but they have to meet certain standards.
Sure. I mean, there's no sense in having a deficient holding facility and you're putting a certain chemical in there. In no way would it pass inspection without meeting its standards. And so definitely the standards of these facilities are going to be there. I would say the vast majority of the companies with these types of holding facilities are meeting these standards. What I've heard with the Freedom Industries is that they were blaming it on the Arctic weather, that this particular compound freezes at a certain level and it dropped and it created a crack and so forth. Well, if that had been registered and we knew the chemical and we knew that, you know, provisions could have been taken put in place in order to prevent it from cracking or spilling, and particularly on regular inspections looking at that facility, this could have been caught prior to something like that happening. Now, if that, what I'm fearful of is if that's the case for that particular facility and we had that spill, the question is how many other facilities that are even further upriver from Charleston or even throughout West Virginia near other communities that also experience this cold weather and the type of weather that's on the verge of also being defective and actually causing a spill. And those are questions that can't be answered right now. And that's what the urgency of putting this piece of legislation through, so that we have the capacity and the information and we can act immediately to try to address this issue in such a way that prevents anything like this happening anywhere in West Virginia. And so the urgency of getting this through immediately so we can have the statutory authority to go in and make that happen is a necessity right now.
Well, John, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity.
While hundreds of thousands of West Virginians are going days without water, a community including an elementary school has not had usable water since September. The flushing process is underway there, but without an upgraded system, customers will have to wait even longer for usable tap water.
My name is Martina Sizemore. I'm 10. It's awful because, I mean, the water's brown and nobody wants to wash their hands with brown water.
Caleb Sizemore. It's pretty bad because you can't wash your hands, you can't drink from the fountains, you can't flush without it being coffee brown.
Herndon Consolidated in Wyoming County has been on a boil water advisory since September. A public service district is working to resolve the problem, but it's taking longer than your ordinary system. Understanding the process gets a little complicated. That involves two PSDs, a small company, and a NASCAR driver. But we'll get to that later. Since the advisory was issued, teachers have tried to create a learning environment with as little distractions as possible, like always having bottled water and hand sanitizer in the classroom. Of course, using the kitchen poses unique challenges. Principal Virginia Lusk shows me around.
You see how we've got cases of water in here stacked up, and we're serving on paper plates. And water comes in these gallon jugs, and they bring them 100 at a time.
The fountains are covered, replaced with a water jug and disposable cups.
Our staff here works so hard, and everybody has, you know, just made it go as smooth as they can. And, you know, the custodians and the cooks have worked their selves, you know, just as hard as they can to make this work and, you know, to keep the kids' safety and the sanitary conditions for the kids.
Oki Mills has taught at the school for more than 15 years.
I'm surprised that many of the parents and people in the community haven't complained more.
The water facility is owned by a small business called Alpoca Waterworks, but the Logan County Public Service District is working to fix the problem. The company is owned by a local family. Principal Virginia Lusk shares what kind of work is needed.
It was outdated and it needed some maintenance done to it, and the owners were unable to do that. And they needed, you know, certified people to be able to do this.
The flushing process is underway, but Logan PSD says it could still take weeks to completely flush the system. There are no hydrants in the district. So for now, each faucet is running, and toilets are flushed often in an effort to reach potable water. In a message, owner Risa Shrewsbury admitted that the water is bad, but said that it's only been that way for a couple months. Shrewsbury says it's because the company lost the water operator. She says the family is selling Alpoca Waterworks. Logan County PSD General Manager William Basden says it's not a simple sale, and the parties are trying to work out ownership issues. Basden says Alpoca Waterworks leased the land from coal companies until the property was purchased by NASCAR driver Greg Biffle. Biffle didn't immediately return our request for comment. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. While West Virginia towns are trying to resolve tap water issues, older communities in Pennsylvania are trying to meet new federal stormwater standards. New guidelines toughen the limits on how much stormwater can enter into rivers and lakes. For many cities, it's proving expensive, especially in older communities where water pipes are crumbling and in need of repair. Some local governments are starting to charge residents a stormwater utility fee. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant visited one Pennsylvania city that recently started what some call a rain tax.
There's a big hole in the street in the small downtown of Meadville, 40 miles south of Erie. More than 70 years ago, much of the city was built over the top of streams, which are enclosed in concrete tunnels called culverts. Assistant City Manager Andy Walker says last summer when Meadville got hit with a huge rainstorm, one of the major tunnels clogged.
Essentially, the culvert became nearly completely plugged with sediment and debris, rocks, branches, some from the storm itself, and frankly from other probably prior events where we hadn't done proper maintenance.
A third of the downtown streets flooded. Cars couldn't get through. The water gushed over and under the roads with so much force, iron manhole covers were pushed up more than 6 feet off the ground. 6 months later, Meadville is still recovering. Walker stands by the hole on Market Street. He says the city had to dig up the street to get to the underground tunnel. Then they had to figure out how to remove the branches and rocks that were plugging it up.
And this is where we had opened it up to literally drag out the debris. And we had a pulley system and dragging a bucket so that we can get it to this hole and then scoop it out with a traditional backhoe and load it out.
The $150,000 price tag may not sound bad, but for a small city like Meadville, it's a significant portion of the budget. Thankfully, Walker says they don't have to spend money from the general fund. Last year, Meadville started charging residents a stormwater utility fee to pay for maintenance and for projects like this. Many call it a rain tax, but Walker doesn't like that term.
And in fact, we try not to call it a tax increase because it is really a user fee.
Walker says like any other utility, water or sewer, people are billed by how much they use it. In the case of a stormwater fee, property owners are charged based on the footage of impervious surfaces, such as parking lots and rooftops on their property. He says rainwater runs off of those surfaces and into the public stormwater system.
Depending on the size of your parcel, that's your billing unit, that's your impact, that's your usage of the system, and you're billed accordingly then.
Last January, the average homeowner started paying a new fee, about $90 per year in Meadville. Cities such as Philadelphia and Mount Lebanon, south of Pittsburgh, have started charging similar fees. More Pittsburgh area municipalities are expected to start considering a stormwater fee this year. We asked a few residents about it at a drugstore on the East End. Matt Marquette is a lawyer and a homeowner on the East End.
I would support any measure that helps develop the infrastructure and limits any sort of pollution that goes into the river waters, which I think are a great local resource.
But others we asked don't want a stormwater fee. In the greeting card aisle, Cheryl Fuller stopped to disparage the idea.
We don't need another bill. We have enough. As homeowners, gas, light, water, sewage, and now a sewer fee? No. No. It's time to become a renter.
The state of Maryland recently passed the country's first statewide stormwater fee. It's expected to cost the average homeowner around $175 a year.
Taxing rainwater. I know it sounds crazy, but that's exactly what the state of Maryland is doing, creating a flood of outrage.
That's Jerry Willis on Fox News. Her guest is a county executive from Maryland, Laura Newman.
So essentially, the amount of rainwater that is outplaced by my structure, my building, my house, I get taxed for that. Is that the way it works?
That's the idea. They're thinking that the amount of impervious surface on your property, meaning your roof, your driveway, your home, will determine the amount of tax that you pay.
I'm telling you, that sounds like a ton of dough. I mean,
well,
I can
imagine. It is.
Newman says the stormwater fee is expected to raise $14 billion by 2025 in Maryland. It won't raise near that much in Meadville, PA, but it's still a lot of money for some businesses and large property owners to pay. Cliff Willis is director of the physical plant at Hilly Allegheny College. Its stormwater utility bill was $70,000 last year. He says not everyone understands why they're being forced to pay for runoff from their parking lots and rooftops.
In any community, particularly a small community, you'll have folks grumbling about additional fees and having to, well, we're just going to move outside the city limits then.
Willis says there is significant development in a nearby township outside Meadville city limits. He says township residents don't pay for police, fire, or stormwater services. But as a former municipal engineer himself, Willis supports the new fee.
I've been here for about 5.5 years, and on at least two occasions, I've seen water running down Main Street deeper than 6 inches. So, yes, there certainly is a need for stormwater management.
Meadville has already spent some of the money mapping its stormwater lines. And when a sinkhole appeared in one homeowner's backyard because of an old line, the city had the $60,000 it needed to build a new one. Meadville's Andy Walker says even with the money from the fee, they can't fix all the problems. He says when 2 inches of rain fell in less than 2 hours last summer, some people wanted the city to clean up water in their homes.
You know, we're sort of demanding action now that they're paying the stormwater fee, and I had to explain to them that, you know, of a storm of that size, no matter what we did, you know, we almost couldn't throw enough money at the problem to fix and prepare for that size event.
Pennsylvania already has a lot of rain and snow, and climate scientists predict larger storms in the coming years. Walker says even with the new fee, fixing the overloaded stormwater system is going to take decades. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
A community in southern West Virginia has come together to clean up the acid mine drainage that had polluted a creek there for decades, effectively choking out all aquatic life. As WMMT's Parker Hobson reports, an organization called the Morris Creek Watershed Association came up with a homemade treatment system, and members feel that a cleaner creek has benefited their rural community.
Deep in the woods above Morris Creek, near the town of Montgomery, West Virginia, Mike King stood ankle deep in a pond full of bright orange muck. This muck wasn't natural, but Mike was happy to see it.
This is what we're catching. This is iron, and that's how fast we're dropping it in this pond right here. Before, it would have to gradually seep all the way through here, and it would go all the way down to the bottom, but we're catching it here.
Mike was working on a homemade method of catching acid mine drainage, or AMD for short, before it could enter Morris Creek, the stream which names Mike's community and flows past his house. AMD is highly acidic water, contaminated with large amounts of trace metals, including iron and aluminum. AMD comes out of openings to particular kinds of coal mines, and as this water leaves the mine and hits the open atmosphere, it starts to lose that high acidity, causing the trace metals to gradually drop out along the length of a stream, turning the water and the stream bed bright orange, just like this pond.
The orange you see is the iron falling out. If you look at that orange, it's about this thick, and it just smothers everything. Nasty, huh?
If left unchecked, enough acid mine drainage can choke out much of the life in a stream. And as Eddie Gray told me, this was the case in Morris Creek for decades, the fault of several openings to old abandoned mine works, constantly discharging polluted water into the creek. Waterways polluted with AMD are familiar sites in many coal mining regions, but starting around 2001, Eddie, Mike, and others in their community decided to take their orange, lifeless creek into their own hands.
You know, Mike and I both grew up here on this watershed as kids, and when we were kids at a very young age, they were, you know, crayfish and other things in the stream. You know, as a kid, we played in creek and caught bait for fishing in the river and things like that. And then shortly after that, you know, when effects of the AMD started to play havoc on the stream, then that aquatic life ceased to exist. So now, being a little older and having kids of our own, my grandkids of his own, so, you know, we wanted to make an effort to try to restore that to the way it was when we were kids.
That's kind of where it started. Started over there at that table.
Wanda King, Mike's wife, was involved in the effort to clean Morris Creek from the beginning.
My kids grew up, the water was orange, and they didn't know it wasn't supposed to be. You know, that's a problem. The more we got into it, the more we saw the things that needed done and needed addressed, and that's how it expanded.
Meeting around Mike and Wanda's kitchen table, a group of community members formed an organization called the Morris Creek Watershed Association, and through it, they started applying for grants from agencies and programs and began organizing volunteer help from the community. They learned there is no one definitive way to deal with AMD, but instead of declaring the problem unsolvable, they embraced the challenge of figuring out how to clean their creek.
My background is in electricity and troubleshooting, and I apply those same theories to everything. I can tell you a lot of things that isn't before I can tell you exactly what it is.
In the spirit of troubleshooting, they tried a method known as a passive treatment system, a series of terraced catching ponds built near where the AMD flows out of the old mines. These ponds were lined with limestone, which reacts with the metals in the water and causes them to fall out more quickly. After a few years, the ponds worked so well in catching the AMD, the limestone became totally covered with iron and ceased being effective, so they changed their design. They sealed off the mine opening and piped the contaminated water directly into a small tank filled with limestone before the water hit the catching ponds. The AMD still dropped out in the ponds, but this new method kept the limestone from getting covered in muck.
There's limestone in this tank, and we just using the force of the water coming off the mountain, it's mixing with the limestone down in the tank. You're giving a shock to the water, and it's kind of like the same process of marinating a steak, that you actually marinate that limestone with the water for a little bit, and you actually get that boost in pH and dropping of metals in a shorter distance. It's someplace between MacGyver and Red Green. So, but it gives you a project to work on. And like I say, you can see it's working. As we stand here, it's working.
So even though their treatment systems have required constant refinement to stay effective, altogether, keeping the acid mine drainage out of the stream has had a transformative effect on its health in a short time.
We have 9 species of fish. We have 3 species of trout. We're the only stream in southern West Virginia that can sustain browns, rainbows, and brook trout in the length of the creek. And considering that when we started in 2001, nothing lived in the creek. The AMD was probably 3 to 4 inches thick in this area. It was just orange muck stuck to the bottom of the creek. We've saved our creek just by being innovative.
But as Mike told me, the Watershed Association's work has grown beyond just treating AMD. There's an electricity generator powered by the water flowing down the mountain into that limestone tank. The group organizes regular stream cleanups. They've started community gardens. 200 hybrid American chestnuts have been planted on the property. University students are undertaking senior projects in the watershed. Local elementary school students regularly release trout into the creek. And those are just some of what Mike told me at last count were 41 different projects, all happening here in Morris Creek.
We have a lot of projects. We can have a lot of people get involved. We want to get folks engaged and see that there is a way to make a difference.
While all of these projects have come from this group's desire to restore their valley to how it looked before the coal mines came, their work is not just focused on the natural environment. It's about the humans, too, and their community.
People's kids don't grow up here. They move away because they have to. You know, that's kind of sad. But it used to be a thriving community, and it slowly went away. We got to do something to get it back.
You know, we kind of have a little saying that, you know, any place that you're doing the work is not the place people want to live. They want to live up on top of the mountain where they can't see the effects. And that's how it is. So all your social and economic and benefits go up on top of the mountain, not down here in the valleys where you're actually toiling and getting the work done. I think if we can reverse some of these environmental degrees that we've done to ourselves and use these as educational tools, if nothing else, we can entice those people to come off that mountain and come back down here with us. And I think as we get this under control, we now have kids that want to move back because we're doing, they can see that we're making a difference.
Wanda feels that in just a few years, their work has helped change perceptions of how people in their community see their home.
I think we've seen a change here in just the community. Everybody seems to take a little more pride in their own homes and just picking up around. They see us out there picking up, then they come join us, A lot of people are excited to see fish back in the creek. You know, they can remember growing up and it was dead. And they're like, oh, there goes trout, So everybody's excited about that. It's hard to see how one person can really do a lot to make a big change. You know, you're fighting a lot of things, but I think as everybody gets on board and it kind of grows that way, you know what I mean?
While Mike feels their group is making a local impact, he thinks that to really clean up Central Appalachia's waterways on a regional level, local watershed protection groups like theirs could stand to get more support, state, federal, and otherwise. For example, Mike told me it wasn't too hard to obtain grant money to build AMD treatment systems, but he said it's incredibly difficult to find funds to actually maintain them, which is necessary to keep them working.
The watersheds are the most underutilized resource that states and agencies have. Watersheds know what's going on. They know what the problems are. They may need help on how to categorize them, how to prioritize them. Yeah. I'd like to see a recon team put together with folks that are dedicated to this kind of work, and you go in and help communities deal with those problems.
There are federal rules requiring coal companies to keep these sorts of AMD problems from happening, but those rules can be subject to wide interpretation, and there are abandoned mines throughout Appalachia and other coal regions still causing AMD, as well as many other environmental problems. Mike is not against coal mining, but he thinks that coal operators will have no real incentive to keep this kind of pollution from happening until company CEOs themselves are held personally responsible.
You know, a lot of people give the EPA flack, say they're trying to ruin coal. Well, the EPA is saying, how are you effectively going to mine the coal and not have this happen again? That's exactly what they're saying. Now, I know the coal companies will say, well, we can't do that cost effectively. Well, if you're giving your CEO $26 million bonuses, you could use a little of that money to come back over here and fix some of these AMD problems. I think we can effectively mine coal. I think we can effectively burn coal. I think we can do a whole host of things when it comes to gas exploration. But we have to have companies, their CEOs, and their board of directors held personally liable when they choose not to follow safety and environmental practices. And that's when we'll make a change.
The Morris Creek Watershed Association has regularly hosted groups of visitors, students, and volunteers from around the country and the world. And moving forward, they have plans to expand their capacity to spread their story even further by building a state-of-the-art environmental education center. This building could have permanent staff and could house large groups of visitors at once, giving even more people reason to visit their small West Virginia town. Mike and Wanda hope the center will build on the success the group has already achieved, with the ultimate hope of instilling pride in the community, bringing economic life to the area, and improving the quality of life for everyone along the creek.
There's no economy here to speak of. And, you know, you have to start somewhere. You have to do something to get businesses interested. I don't know if our little building would do that, but it sure wouldn't hurt.
But regardless of what happens with the building or any of their other projects, the acid mine drainage is going to keep flowing down from the mountain. If their current setup ever starts to fail like the last one did, Mike and his organization seem likely to welcome all help in doing whatever it takes to keep their creek clean, whatever that whatever might be.
I'm one of these folks that I just like to get involved and do something. I don't like to sit around and talk about it. I like planning and strategic planning. But you can only do so much of that. Then you have to put something into action. You have to get folks that see a value in trying some of these methods. And if we fail, what have we lost? Well, let's go look at more stuff.
For more information on the Morris Creek Watershed Association, you can find them on Facebook or by visiting morriscreekwatershed.org. Reporting for WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Hard-to-fight infections are attracting the attention of Kentucky's lawmakers. As WEKU's Stu Johnson reports, a public health expert recently briefed lawmakers on the growing risk.
Dr. Kevin Cavanaugh with Kentucky-based HealthWatch USA says the increasing risk of contagions, such as potentially deadly staph infections and untreatable gastrointestinal bacteria, justify tougher measures. For example, Kavanaugh says hospitals need to expand their use of antibiotic ointments and antiseptics.
All hospitals can be doing it, either with surveillance and testing of individual patients, or some hospitals may choose to use the universal decolonization, or essentially just treating everybody as if they had MRSA.
MRSA is another name for staph infections. Still, Kavanaugh says the numbers remain soft, so creating an adequate statewide response will be difficult. As for the Kentucky Hospital Association, spokeswoman Elizabeth Cobb says her members are active. Cobb says many hospitals employ experts who focus solely on infection prevention and treatment. For example, they track patients who may spread infections from one facility to another.
Looks at the number of times that they have been in any type of healthcare facility and really analyzes whether that patient is at a high risk for either carrying an infection or getting an infection.
Cobb adds they must report any cases of infection to a national database. Public health advocates say more information will help them win their fight against infections. However, House Health and Welfare Committee member Robert Benvenuti believes the state has a relatively good handle on the problem.
Kentucky has a regulation on this, and that I haven't heard any evidence that our hospitals are in non-compliance. If there's evidence of non-compliance, then that needs to be forwarded to the Inspector General's office.
There was also discussion about county health departments taking a key role raising awareness about the risk of infections. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
The National Science Foundation had recommended closing the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, and efforts have been underway to keep that from happening. In the meantime, West Virginia University is investing $1 million over the next 2 years to support the facility. And as West Virginia Public Radio's Beneduccio reports, the telescope is still making remarkable astronomical discoveries, including one that's being called a puzzle by WVU astronomers.
There is a very unique star formation in the Milky Way galaxy that until recently was never discovered. It's known as a triple star system, two white dwarf stars and a pulsar. A pulsar is a star that gives off radio waves. White dwarf stars are very dense, some as massive as our sun, and they have stored thermal energy. This particular grouping is somewhat rare, according to West Virginia University physics professor Duncan Lorimer.
It's something of a mystery as to how it's formed. We're quite used to the idea now, and we're comfortable with the observations of pulsars being the end products of supernova explosions, the end states of massive stars. We're comfortable with the idea of those objects being isolated and moving around the Milky Way and other stellar systems. But this triple stellar system, where you have two white dwarf stars, is something of a puzzle as to its origin, how it got there. The orbits are very organized, and they're all essentially in the same plane. And so there's a very special set of circumstances must have occurred to produce this system. Probably very, very rare.
But Lorimer says there are clues to help researchers track the system's origin.
The way we think about this is the pulsar is essentially a clock in space. And it's sending out these regular pulses that we receive with the Green Bank telescope and other telescopes. We can use it to monitor its position in the orbit and hence determine to very high precision many, many orbital parameters. We're able to measure the mass of the pulsar. So it's really a one-of-a-kind system.
The significance of this discovery is that it's allowing researchers to test a scientific principle known as the strong equivalence principle. Lorimer explains.
That is to say that bodies fall in a gravitational field in a way that's independent of their chemical composition or internal composition. And that's been done many times over the years on the moon. There's a very famous movie where the astronaut drops a feather and a hammer, I believe it is, and that you can see that they fall at the same rate in the absence of drag. And here we have a pulsar and a white dwarf being pulled by another white dwarf, essentially. And so we can watch them fall in that gravitational field independently. And now we're testing this principle on objects that are very much more exotic.
This system was discovered by a former West Virginia University student who is now a faculty member at Western Kentucky University. The tool used to make this important discovery is the Green Bank Telescope. Funding for the telescope is in doubt due to the nation's financial struggles. Lorimer says the telescope is a vital tool in how astronomers are able to look at the universe. He fears without it, more important discoveries like this one can't be made.
This is not by no means the only example of what the GBT has done over the last few years, just for pulsar science alone. And it has a whole slew of other very interesting scientific questions that it's answering in a unique way. So yes, I'm very concerned that the future of the telescope is uncertain. The telescope is potentially getting cut off well before its time.
Karen O'Neill is the site director at Green Bank. She says the facility is an open skies facility, which means any astronomer from around the world can apply for time to get on the telescope. She says when astronomers make discoveries with the telescope, there's a little bit of luck involved, but mostly it's hard work. And the telescope itself, which is the largest fully steerable telescope in the world, certainly helps.
Could this discovery have been made without the GBT? Possibly. But did the GBT make this discovery vastly more likely? Absolutely.
O'Neill says this particular discovery was made while astronomers were looking for related systems, but they certainly didn't expect to find this particular one. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
Kentucky's third annual sandhill crane hunting season wrapped up last week. As KPR's Erica Peterson reports, fish and wildlife officials are calling it a success.
The most recent numbers show 87 birds were killed in this year's sandhill crane hunting season, mostly in Barron County. That's slightly lower than last year, when 92 birds were killed. But both years, the actual hunt fell far below the quota of 400 birds the Department of Fish and Wildlife set. Wildlife biologist John Brunges says nearly 400 people got permits to hunt sandhill cranes this year, but many weren't successful.
They're an extremely difficult bird to hunt, and the biggest limiting factor is there's only a few places where they occur in the state.
When Kentucky first began allowing sandhill crane hunting in 2011, it was controversial. Opponents argued the birds aren't overpopulated or damaging the environment and should be protected. This year, Brunges says there were about 68,000 birds in the sandhill crane's eastern population. If that number ever fell below 30,000, that would trigger an automatic halt to the hunting season. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Mahatma Gandhi is widely recognized as a leader of Indian nationalism in British-ruled India who employed nonviolent civil disobedience and inspired civil rights movements across the world. A professor at West Virginia University's College of Law recently published a book that explores a side of Gandhi most are not familiar with, his early years as a lawyer in South Africa. As West Virginia Public Radio's Glynis Board reports, it's the first extensive examination of this chapter in Gandhi's life.
Practically every Indian in Johannesburg was in the crowd outside the courthouse, awaiting word of Gandhi's fate. When the news of the magistrate's decision arrived, an ocean of small black flags appeared as if on command. Spontaneous chanting broke out. Following a very large single black flag, hoisted aloft on a long pole, the crowd surged out of the square in a procession that would take it onto the street where Gandhi's office was located. Gandhi, meanwhile, was taken to a holding room to await his jailers. As he sat there...
That's author and endowed Woodrow A. Potesta Professor of Law, Charles DeSalvo, reading an excerpt of his new book, The Man Before the Mahatma, M.K. Gandhi, Attorney at Law.
The square where he addressed a large public meeting just a short time ago. Now these were all being taken from him. The thought shook him. For the first time in his life, he was going to prison.
DeSalvo says producing this work that explores Gandhi's early life in South Africa had been a personal goal of his since he discovered that Gandhi was, in fact, a lawyer for 25 years before becoming a pacifist reformer in India.
I was astounded because he becomes a civil disobedient while he's a practicing lawyer. While he's a practicing lawyer, he develops his philosophy and his practice of nonviolent civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. And I ask myself, is there not a connection between these two, between his practice of law and his development of this philosophy? And why hasn't anybody explored this? So I just decided to make it my mission to do that.
DeSalvo gives much credit to the many law and history students who, along with him, read through some 10,000 newspapers from South Africa, which held keys to unlocking details of Gandhi's career as a lawyer and a politician. DeSalvo says it was that Herculean effort that perhaps prevented anyone else from writing this book earlier. One intriguing insight, DeSalvo says Gandhi had a near-terminal case of shyness, an unlikely quality for an aspiring lawyer. He says Gandhi's severe stage fright made the start of his career, publicly presenting cases, rather rocky.
In fact, in one of his first cases in India, where he tried to launch a practice and failed, he had to basically withdraw from the case because he was too nervous in court.
DeSalvo explains that it was in South Africa, which at the time was considered something of a backwater, where he worked to overcome his fear.
And he grew in that. He rose to the occasion, and he changed. Before he leaves South Africa, before he gives up the practice of law, he's on his feet giving speeches that last 2 and more hours. This is how much he changed. He became the Mahatma in South Africa.
Today, DeSalvo says he feels he could go back in time and feel quite comfortable strolling through the streets of Durban and Johannesburg with Gandhi. And he says there were certainly surprises in his journey getting to know the lawyer who became the legend. He points to one example of a tactic that Gandhi, a consummate politician, used to secure the rights of Indians in British South Africa.
The British South Africa, of course, was run by Europeans who identified with the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Because Indians were also members of the empire, Gandhi's argument was, we are fellow members of the empire. You should not be discriminating against us. We are not like these black people.
Wow.
We are better than they are. We are different from them, and you should not treat us like them. It was shocking to see that.
DeSalvo points out that nevertheless, Nelson Mandela would come to lionize Gandhi. He says Mandela recognized that young Gandhi was developing and would someday be a friend to the black community. He hopes that he and all his students take a lesson from the path to Mahatma.
At first, there's a strong distinction between his legal work and the work that is fueled by his politics, his morality, and his spirituality. Eventually, those two come a little closer when he starts devoting some of his practice to civil rights work. And then at the end of his practice, his entire practice is devoted to his political, moral, and spiritual beliefs. And at that point, he becomes integrated. There's only one Gandhi at that point. There's not two. Mm-hmm. There's one. And to me, that is a goal for myself and for all lawyers, that we should have practices that in some respect, none of us can do this the way Gandhi did, in some respect, our practices are an expression of who we are politically, morally, and spiritually.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glennis Ford in Morgantown.
Kentucky poet laureate Frank X. Walker is among the nominees for the 45th Annual NAACP Image Awards. Walker is nominated in the category of Outstanding Literary Work, Poetry, for his latest book, Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers. The NAACP Image Awards highlight achievements in art, entertainment, politics, and culture. The nominees and winners of the awards are selected by a group of NAACP members. Walker says he was excited to find out about the nomination. Walker is an associate professor of English at the University of Kentucky. The NAACP Image Awards will be announced February 21st for non-televised categories. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Pettaway and Amy White from their CD Land of the Sky from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpubcast.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.